The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
This is from Bodhidharma's Bloodstream Sermon. Buddha means awareness, the awareness of body and mind that prevents evil from arising in either. To invoke means to call to mind, to call constantly to mind the rules of discipline and to follow them with all your might. This is what's meant by invoking. Invoking has to do with thought and not language. If you use a trap to catch a fish, once you succeed, you forget the trap. And if you use language to find meaning, once you find it, you can forget the language. To invoke the Buddha's name, you have to understand the Dharma of invoking. If it's not present in your mind, your mouth chants an empty name. As long as you're troubled by the three poisons, which is greed, anger, and ignorance, or by thoughts of yourself, your deluded mind will keep you from seeing the Buddha, and you'll only waste your effort. Chanting and invoking are worlds apart. Chanting is done with the mouth. Invoking is done with the mind. And because invoking comes from the mind, it's called the door to awareness. Chanting is centered in the mouth and appears as sound. If you cling to appearances while searching for meaning, you won't find a thing. Thus, sages of the past culted introspection, not speech. So, I've been thinking a lot about liturgy, and I wanted to give a talk on liturgy, and so I started to work on that, and I realized, I can't talk about liturgy, because it's experiential, for sure. And it's hard to teach this invocation of our mind, where we are in our mind. So I'm going to do my best to speak about liturgy. And we had a precepts retreat yesterday, and the word opening came up. And that really struck me, this word opening this door to awareness, being opened, being uncovered, unfolding. Seems like the right season to talk about opening. After all, that's sort of the force that's happening. Things are opening. What is it to be open? What is it to be open to liturgy and be opened by liturgy? And so this is one of the eight gates that Daido set up, this gate of liturgy, which he calls his chapter in the eight gates, making visible the invisible. If that's not a koan for us, what is making visible the invisible? Yeah, liturgy, it for me today, and I hope maybe you'll feel it, is really helpful in this time, in this present time, to, since it is perceived and subtly answered, that our thought, what we do with our mind, has a lot of reverberations. And a sense, like what we chanted this morning, is we're all doing good speech together. We're creating a ritual of good speech and putting that out there, letting that reverberate. Kaz Ta-Nehisi did a book on Zen chanting, and he wrote, a Zen chant is like a compass that sets us in the direction of the awakened life. It is the dynamic, audible counterpart to the silent practice of Zazen, and it is a powerful expression of the fact that practice happens in community. So Daido says in this, he has this book called The Eight Gates of Zen. For those that are new, that's our training matrix, ways that we train based on the Eightfold Path of the Buddha. And he starts off, I'll just say a little bit about his words, just as in the arts of painting, poetry, music, and dance, Zen, in Zen liturgy, we manifest that which is known to us intuitively and subconsciously in the form of a visible, tangible reality. In this way, liturgy tends to make palpable the common experience of a group. There is, however, very little explanation of liturgy generally available. It is rare to see a substantive work on the subject in Buddhism or in any other major religion, because it is experiential. It's a very direct experience. And I know in my first encounters with Zen liturgy, my brain was crackling. I mean, even to read, it's the common experience of a group. I'm like, what does common mean now? What is experience and what's a group? I don't know, it puts everything into question. I can't take for granted that I understand any of these simple words. Anything, and as well as to presume anything about this mysterious non-self espoused in Buddha Dharma. So there's a whole different cast on words. I remember when I first came to the monastery, just like some of you this morning, right into liturgy, the morning service. And the person greeted me at the front door. They said, welcome. And they said, we're going to start with morning service. There's going to be some chanting and bowing. You okay with that? And I was like, I don't know. what does that mean? Like, what kind of bow? Like, bowing? I don't know. Sure, I can bow. Full prostrations. I was like, okay, yeah, okay. So, yeah, I'm okay with that. And so the bell starts, and it's like this, like the whole community just started like moving around like we do. Some people were sitting, and then everyone knew like it was time to stand up and take this place. And I don't know, it was very earthy. It was like we were all just, and everyone was barefoot. Like that really was so exciting to me that we took our shoes off and we're just like raw, touching the earth. When I used to make latkes with my grandmother, she used to say, take your shoes off, it's going to taste better. And the food tastes better. So I was remembering that. I was like, oh, okay, this is going to taste really good. We're barefoot. No hats, you know, everything just sort of in. And I felt like, oh, there's a ritual taking place here. Like there's incense happening and instruments, and some people had robes, I didn't. And people had positions and they seemed to know what to do. And I was just really like, wow, this thing's just going along really nicely with precision and with care. And something spoke really powerfully to my heart and mind in those moments, which I can't articulate, but maybe you feel it too. It just starts to like move in us, right? That's the liturgy happened, the ritual, and how we appreciate ritual. And it was felt celebratory, and it also felt kind of sublime, and everyone was silent. Some people were looking down, and so I was kind of peeking because I didn't know what was going on. And I didn't know about lowering my eyes. That was something to really trust. And then I received a sutra book, and then there's these words like a heart sutra. And I was like, a heart sutra? What could that be? A heart sutra. And then I hear form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. And so the chant's going along, and I'm still on that phrase and seeing, like, did anybody hear that? Like, what is that? And then the identity of relative and absolute, like, what is that? Truth? What is truth? Like, this is the truth, not a lie. And I'm like, what's the truth and not a lie? And do I agree with that? And all kinds of stuff. sound syllables, just like no, mo, son. And I was just like, okay, I'm here to do it. I'm going to do it. So I just tried to keep opening and opening. And I remember when bowing, I don't know if I had bowed before. It was different in the religion I was brought up in, but I didn't know where everyone went. Like, everyone dropped down to the floor, and I was really nervous about that because suddenly you can't see anything. So I was, again, peeking out the side, and then it's like raising the Bodhi mind. It's like the Buddha's on, you're holding the Buddha on the palm of your hands, and you raise the Buddha by your ears. You're raising your Bodhi mind. That's what I found out later. And putting your hands down, so I did that too. I did everything. And there was this feeling of like just open and just surrender, doing the best I could, trying to stay in curiosity and wonder. And, you know, a lot of us come into Zen with our backgrounds in religion, and Zen is said to be non-theistic. So it doesn't take up whether or not there exists a God as being relevant to seeing the nature of oneself, one's nature. But a lot of us have a lot of discomfort with bowing. And, you know, it's not, nothing's external in Zen liturgy. So it's all an expression of identity. So when we have a Buddha on the altar, we're identifying with our own wakefulness. And these are just reminders of who we are. So it's identity. But there's a lot of, many people have discomfort. And even with ritual, it's like, I like the sitting part, I like the talk, but I don't like the liturgy. In fact, my teacher, Daito Roshi, used to sneak out when he was in training in ZCLA. He would leave when liturgy started. And so we have these people that watch the Zendo, and they would see him going. He had this pattern of like liturgy started and out he went. And he said he would go to the diner and get a sandwich and then come back when the teacher was going to talk. And so Tetsugin and like his Dharma brothers would get ready, and Mizumi would say, let him go. His teacher would say, let him go. I see it. Let him go. And he did this for a while, and he was just watching him. And then somewhere along that line, his son became ill, had a brain tumor, 3-year-old son. And Daito went in to his teacher, and he said, well, would it be okay if the Sangha chanted for your son on the healing list? And there was Daito like, oh boy, you know, liturgy. And he was, at that point, he was just open. Mizumi went right for it. And from that point on, he was so moved by liturgy and what it was doing for him and the Sangha, the community, like putting all this energy towards his son that was ill, that it became one of the most important practices for Daito. So that's why it is a lot of what we do here. And, you know, sometimes we're have discomfort with ritual, but all throughout our day, if you look at it, your day, isn't there ritual? I mean, you get up, you put your feet on the floor, you maybe go and make something to drink, or you go to the bathroom, that's your ritual, and then you have a certain drink, and then maybe you take a shower, and then maybe you sit, maybe you will sit, or maybe you dance, I don't know. And all through the day, there's order that we make in things we do. That's ritual, right? But somehow we come here and it's like there's too much ritual. So this is where it involves staying open, because we can't base things on what we might assume or what we've been brought up to. At least if we can be open, we can say, oh, that's coming up. Let me ask a few more questions. Be curious. Is this what I did years ago that really turned me off and da, da, da? And so Mizumi Roshi, I wanted to share with him, he writes a chapter in his book on Let Us Appreciate, on ceremonial action. He says, it's interesting to reflect on how many of the most basic routines of our lives are conducted in an orderly way within a particular form. When our actions are conducted in this way, they become ceremony. What is ceremony? And then he says, in Latin, ceremony is caramonia, which is related to cura, which means cure. The act of healing or of being healed. In other words, ceremony is an act that cures or heals, or by which something is healed. In having a ceremony or in doing ceremonial action, we must ask, what is healed? By what? You know, sometimes when people are ill, I say, there is one who is not ill, taking care of the ill person, even as we're sick. And I remember that myself, as I'm laying down, tucked in the covers, drinking water, doing what I have to do. There is one who is not ill, taking care. The word heal means to be healthy, to be whole and sound. To make our life healthy is ceremonial. In order to live a healthy life, we live ceremonially every day, regardless of our culture, country, or race. From morning to night, we live our lives through rituals, don't we? We get up, we wash our face, we brush our teeth, and Dogen has a lot of fascicles, Master Dogen, on these very rituals we do. We brush our teeth and eat, go about our simple routines in an orderly way. Work can be an act of ceremony. Wouldn't that be nice? Like, if you think of your work as like, I'm going to a ceremony. And you go in the office, you say hello to everyone. That's part of the ceremony. It's part of the ritual. How are you doing today? Oh, really? What's up? So you can think now of your entire day as being in liturgy, in ceremony. It's nice. The definition of ceremony also includes the word law, the laws of life. From morning until night, our life is a continuous ritual governed by rules, regulations, and laws. Behaving informally, we follow the laws or regulations. What are the laws and regulations that are essential to living a healthy life? What do we follow? What do we abide by? It's interesting. It says, who do you think creates the casual, disorderly way of life? I do. The ego does. Ceremony can be understood as a form of discipline by which we avoid self-centeredness, which causes us difficulties. And there's much more if you want to go to his book on Let Us Appreciate. So, Dido speaks about making visible the invisible. Give you a chance to let your brain crackle with that for a moment. And in his book, he says, this is from Celebrating Everyday Life, what does it mean to make visible something which is invisible? He says, essentially, it means to bring that something into the awareness of the six consciousnesses, which we chanted this morning, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And in addition, the five awarenesses, hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, and touching, and then the five organs, eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body. And so he says, Buddhism identifies mind itself as an organ that perceives. The organ of perception and the object it perceives, together with consciousness, produce what we call reality. So you need an organ of perception, an object of perception it perceives with consciousness. If any of those are not there, there's no reality. So a thing becomes real, what we call real, when the organ of perception, its object, and consciousness come together. My eye, the object that it sees, and consciousness combine to form a tangible reality. He says, when you consider mind as one of the organs of perception, the concept of reality expands beyond the boundaries usually accepted in the West, he says. The object of mind is thought. Mind, thought, and consciousness thus create a reality. Making visible means we are able to perceive through the organs of perception that something is there. Though invisible. What is it that is invisible? What is the common experience of the Buddhist community that is restated in our liturgy? So just before we start a talk, if you remember what we just did, the big case started over here, got our attention, vibrated. Bong, bong. We're all silent. Hands are going to gassho, which is an expression of unifying one reality. And then we chant this gatha on opening the sutra, the Dharma, incomparably profound and infinitely subtle, is rarely encountered even in millions of ages. Now we see it, we hear it, we receive and we maintain it. May we completely realize the Tathagata's true meaning. I think one of the most important words is now. Now, this present moment. We see it, we hear it, we receive, and we maintain it, making visible the invisible. The past is gone. Future hasn't happened yet. Neither of those is reality. Only in this moment, right now. This is it. Right now is what we have. This strange and wondrous now that just slipped and there's now and just went and now and now and now and now and now and now and now. Because we can't grasp it because it doesn't have a length. It doesn't have substance. If that ain't wondrous, I don't know what is. So this is a gatha, which is a short poem or a verse. Gatha on opening the sutra. So opening. What is opening for you? What is opening for you? Most of us want to be open. We definitely want to have openings. People come and tell me, I want an opening. But it's happening all the time. Maybe it's allow access, not playing at the entrance. We brought this up in the precepts. Somebody said, opening is to be impacted by, surrendering, accepting. What exactly is being opened in this sutra? What is the sutra? So to see the Dharma, we need to let go of our limited ways of measuring things. It's just not, we see it, we hear it, we receive and uphold its boundlessness openly. And Buddha woke up out of the sleep of what he thought he was into the reality of what each of us really is. Now, the origin of this sutra is a lot of, I didn't spend a whole lot of time, but it is in the Lotus Sutra, in chapter on expedient means, skillful means. But it said it has origins in China. They found something very similar in about 500 to 700 CE. But counts vary. Anyways, our true nature is vast open space. That's our true nature, boundless. We hear it. So we may feel some things pushing against, which might be our beliefs, our strong-held beliefs, our positions, which we can inquire about. So what might I need to open before we start? You know, we say these talks tend to be dark to the mind, but radiant to the heart. So there's a little hint. These talks tend to be dark to the mind, but radiant to the heart. And they require a different kind of listening. Maybe that's part of the meaning of opening. And opening the sutra. The sutra is the scriptures. It's also said to be the words of the Buddha. The Tathagata is another name for Buddha. But sutra, like their suture, when we get stitched up, is exactly what it is. It says, interwoven of strings in vertical and horizontal. That's sutra. Interwoven strings of vertical and horizontal. Isn't that what our human life is? Could we be the sutra? Could you be the sutra? Is that the sutra we're opening? Is this a verse on how to open ourselves to the Dharma, to everything? Interwoven, up and down, because we're not fixed. So it's a fast-moving system of momentariness being woven up and down. Constant flow, a dynamic moving vast network, a tapestry of threads merging into a constant flow. Looks like this, looks like this, this. Kinhin is called a walking sutra. That's what we are. We're all stitched together, walking, walking sutra. Interwoven steps like stitches. One teacher wrote, we have to see that clearly, then taste it to see the real picture of our life. A huge network of interwoven time and space. Even though we see the momentariness or instant that we exist day to day, it consists of a huge network of interwoven time and space. An instant has this kind of vast structure. So if we have clinging or grasping to our own prejudice, if we grasp at our desire, at the expense of everything and anyone else, we know it's really, how's that going? It's difficult to open our life. It's a sticky network. And so we can feel that. We can feel, it's like a spider web, you know? There's certain things that will get stuck. So we have to practice to open ourselves, to see the real picture of our life. And Zazen is that, of course. That's where we can practice very directly to open ourselves. Thought arises. We don't judge it. Or maybe we do. We see that. We don't have to. We let it go. We open to it. And we open to coming back to our breath. Surrendering. Allowing access to those fast-moving networks of interwoven time and space. Now we open our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, and see what's true. And that truth that we see is called the Dharma. Whatever comes to us that we see to be tested and real and true is the Dharma. And Dida used to give us a warning, if you remember. He says, if any teacher tells you, I have the truth, he said, run for your life. Run for your life. We need to find out what is real and true and test it in our life. That is opening the sutra. if, as we open this sutra, the huge network of interweaving time and space, if we do that, we find it is incomparably profound and infinitely subtle, sometimes called penetrating Dharma. So Dharma is a very full Buddhist term. I'm not going to go into Dharma, but just kind of give you these three principles that are, I think, important for now. It's the principle of existence, this Dharma, all phenomena, visible or invisible, and the teachings of the Buddha. Mainly compassion that extends everywhere is the Dharma. And all of this is at a state, as a category, a state of always functioning at super speed, constantly supporting, helping, and nurturing all beings. If you come to see this state of being, realizing this is true, is Dharma, it said that we will be completely, constantly supported and helped and nurtured. We will feel that. Said the inside needs to be like a hollow, like a reed. You know, sometimes teachers used to speak of kinhin as a hollow reed walking. Like when we walk kinhin, walk like you're a hollow reed. So we say, you know, let go of counting. And it's the same as Zazen. We're just walking. So when thoughts come up, we're not hollow anymore. We're filling ourselves up. You know, should I do this? I can't wait till we go to lunch, whatever. And we let that go and we walk like we're hollow, a hollow reed. I like that. It's helpful. Nothing to grasp. This too is a meaning of Dharma. Constantly supporting, upholding, helping, nurturing all beings, and the inside is hollow, not unfeeling, just empty of grasping, that kind of hollow. The Dharma, incomparably profound, very profound. Some translations say penetrating, but originally it says profound or profundity, deep. Unfathomable. This is one of the characteristics of the Zen arts. Sublime profundity. And I think of it, I always think of it as a, when I have a pot with a certain glaze, or I've seen pots with certain glazes, and you look in and you can't tell where the bottom is. You just can't see, tell the bottom. And it's just, it has its form, but you can't see the bottom. You can't see the depth of it. I think of it like that kind of profundity. We cannot touch it, but we can be there if we can open ourselves, open our heart. We can see it and be present exactly in peace and harmony right there. This now, it's what's speaking of, is profound, infinitely, subtle, wondrously inconceivable. We can't pin it down what it is, but it's working with us if we can open to it. That's, you know, when we fill ourselves with all the things we fill ourselves with, but if we can open to it. Category, Roshi continues, meeting it objectively, we cannot know what it is. We can't explain it. Speaking subjectively, we can experience it. Exactly, we can know. Yet, it is with us. Difficult to say what it is objectively is called subtle. Very subtle. Infinitely subtle. Our mind cannot pin down what it is, and we can experience it and know it is always with us. So Dharma is supreme, incomparably profound, unmatchable, beyond comparison, and subtle, very subtle. Because we can experience it, we can teach it to people. We can transmit it. This is our responsibility, each of us, whatever Dharma you realize we let move on whatever goodness it brings. We have to transmit this Dharma, and it's rarely encountered, even in millions of ages. Some say kalpas. What's a kalpa? Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. We rarely meet with, even in hundreds of millions of kalpas of ages. So aren't we the lucky ones? We don't understand how rare it is. I don't. I hear that a lot, but it's beginning to get to me. Like, wow, it is rare. I mean, 9.5 billion people on the planet, the Dharma to be encountered, it doesn't have to be through Buddhism. Ages, kalpa, that's an expression of time that's boundless, eternal. Let's just say it's a, when you write long time, very rare for us to be born as human beings, very rare to us to have the opportunity to meet and listen to Buddhist teachings and practice Zazen together. So those of you that showed up today, whew, I'd love to meet each one of you and say, what was it that you turned to the Dharma? This opportunity to express ourselves as we are. And then maybe we make contact that it's important to have our spiritual life. We do make contact and to take care of it. And then that spurs us on to pay attention in Zazen, which I feel is happening more and more. More and more. Even you, those of you, I mean, some of us have sat before. I realize when I was a newcomer, there were a lot of newcomers. Some of us have meditated before in various ways. But it's rare, and we may not get this opportunity again for millions of ages. And now we see it, we hear it, we receive, we accept, and we open to be impacted and maintain it. And so there's this spiral of practice. We practice it, we realize it, we actualize it, we manifest it. We practice it, we realize it, we actualize it, we manifest it. And that continues endlessly. That's an enlightened life. Buddhism does go for the long view. And when we see the real picture now, that affects the past and it affects our actions going into the future in this now. So it's all one reality. So whatever happened in the past can actually be worked with now and affect that past and how it moves forward. That's how we change things, change karma, work with our karma, our actions, what we make of ourselves through our actions. May we completely realize the Tathagata's true meaning. That's the last line. May we completely realize the Buddha's true meaning. Really taste the truth of it, of what the Buddha was saying about our nature, our Buddha nature, being perfect and complete, lacking absolutely nothing. All beings, all things in that way, never fail to cover the ground upon which they walk. If practice does have a goal, it's to see the reality of each being like that, including this one on your cushion. Doesn't mean we don't have stuff to work on, so don't get confused about perfection. Wondrous and difficult to grasp and not different from the ceremony of our everyday life, day to day. This is what it is to meet the Dharma, to see it, to hear it, receive and maintain it. And then when we experience that, we can't help but want to understand it more deeply. We keep wanting to deepen ourselves in the Dharma, to realize the Buddha's true meaning once we taste it. That's why Trungpa says, if you start on this path, be careful, because you won't be able to turn back. Because now you know something. And it's harder to go against what you know to be true, that you've seen and realized. It's hard to turn back. We can try. It's really hard. So some people, they say, I left practice, and then they come back. And I'm like, no, you didn't. Not at all. You know, yeah, maybe you didn't show up here, and I haven't seen you for 20 years, but here you are. You haven't left. You never did. You couldn't. Sorry. It's too late. First day you walked in, too late. So this verse is saying something so vivid and directly about our life. Stay open and to let it be this unknowable mystery that it is. Nozomi Roshi's words, when we carefully understand our lives, every bit of life becomes ceremonial action, an open, orderly, ordinary life, and we should take care in this way. This is liturgy. This is ceremony. Do you see? And in closing, I'll just share a prayer by somebody named Dana Faulds. She's a practitioner, I think, she's a practitioner. She writes, I like her writing because she writes about Dharma, and that can get kind of syrupy sometimes, but I think hers is okay, you'll see. I like it. I pray to stay open today, open to the unrestrained energy of now, open to mystery and power, open to whatever comes, open to routine and surprises, open to moving past my first reactions, open to my imperfections and the divine spark that underlines them, open to the wonder and the everyday grace of life unfolding as it does. Open to events and circumstances that I like and that I don't like. Open to fatigue and the overflowing energy. Open to listen and to speak. Open to love in all the ways it manifests. Open to give and to receive. Open to the seasons changing, priorities rearranging, nothing staying the same for very long. Open to letting beliefs dissolve into the ether. Open to the direct experience of truth. Open to forgetting and remembering. Open to life and open to death. Open to seeing old patterns and letting them go. Open to fear and to courage, ease and difficulty. I pray to stay open.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats and residency, please visit our website at zmm.org/zcnyc.